live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm your host, Tracy Ellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. You can email me with your questions, tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov. That's T-R-A-C-Y dot E-L-L-I-S at leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100, 509-826-0100. Well, here in Olympia, the topic that everyone, House, Senate, Governor's Office, kitchen table, talking about is the budget, taxes. It was kind of a wild week last week, Senator Short, with those conversations with the governor basically coming out against what Senate and House Democrats have proposed as far as the budget goes. Why don't you give us an update on what's going on with the budget right now?
Sure. Well, the budget process at this point normally is that you would start, you know, having a process of ironing out the differences between the two budgets. It's called the conference committee process. It's essentially two House Democrats, two Senate Democrats, and then one each Republican, although generally we're not in the room for those final negotiations. But look, the reason I bring it up is the governor's comments about saying basically do-over. What that's going to lend itself to is a lack of transparency in how those final budgets are put together and frankly what they look like. And so we made a big deal of that on the Senate floor and said, look, we should not have, you know, a group of legislators closed door finish out the budget. We should really, you know, each entity should put together what they think the governor may or may not support, you know, keeping with the comments that he made, and send it back and forth. So the Senate could send their new proposal to the House and House to the Senate, vice versa. And the reason I say that is because it keeps it an open process. It keeps it a process where folks can see what the majority's thinking. The problem is the way it is now, of course, it goes in closed room, you know, closed door negotiations, essentially. And the budget, if it keeps with the spirit of where the governor would like it to go, is going to look markedly different. So I just think, again, in the spirit of transparency, it should continue to go back and forth, you know, in the open between the chambers, just as legislation does. When you start negotiating changes in legislation or how a House bill was changed or a Senate bill was changed, that's the regular process, folks. So we think it should continue that way.
Representative Abel, you're on the Finance Committee in the House. A lot of tax proposals coming in front of your committee. Talk a little bit about some of those and why you don't like them.
Yeah, so many reasons why I don't like them. First of all, I just want to say I think it was wise of the Senate R's to take that stand for transparency in this process as these competing budget proposals come together. I think that was an outstanding and correct message to send out to the people of Washington. Yeah, you're exactly right, Tracy. So I serve on the Finance Committee. The Finance Committee is the tax writing committee here in Olympia. And as the Democrats attempt to deal with this self-created, self-inflicted wound of a budget deficit, they are reaching repeatedly for the tax dial to try and turn up the taxes. And right now, there are a series of tax proposals, tax increase proposals that are on the table, including a property tax increase, which is incredibly disconcerting for me. I mean, we hear all the time about individuals, including retirees, those who are on fixed incomes, being very concerned about being taxed out of their homes. And we've got a colleague in the House, Representative Orchid, who says repeatedly that if you can't pay your property taxes, he asks, what happens if you can't pay your property taxes, kind of rhetorically. And the answer is they auction it off on the courthouse steps. That's how serious it is. And so we're talking about people's ability to stay in their homes. Also an increase in the B&O tax, which is very concerning. This is essentially a tax on some of our most successful companies here in the state of Washington. A proposed wealth tax, and I want to talk about that for a minute because the dynamics around that are super interesting. So Senator Short mentioned that the governor has indicated there are problems with the current budget proposals, and he specifically said he's not going to sign a budget that includes the untested, legally dubious wealth tax. So that was good news, from my perspective. Now, he did leave the door open to potentially other tax increases, which I think was bad news from my perspective, but at least right now he seems to be indicating that is off the table. There's also a proposal for an increase in the gas tax, another 9-cent increase in the gas tax, which, you know, as we've talked about before on this radio, that's a really significant extra burden on those of us who live in rural areas. It just takes a lot more time and a lot more gas in order to get from Inchilim to, OMAC or Spokane or East Wenatchee than it would take for somebody who lives in Bellevue to get to the airport in SeaTac. That's just a fact of life of living in a rural area. So a whole bunch of bad tax proposals that are out there. We are hoping that more are going to go by the wayside, but I'm watching in particular this proposal for the property tax increase. I think that's really devastating for those of us who are on limited incomes and trying to make sure they're able to stay in their homes.
Representative Engel, you had a bill actually pass out of the Senate. In, to be honest with you, you had a real champion in the Senate for this bill. This is a passionate speech given by Senator Short, not over the budget, not over parental rights, but over a Class B water systems. So here we. Some people.
Hope that was good.
So some people might say, some legislators may say, when a bill like this comes in front of them, good bill, vote yes. Not Senator Short.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is a bill brought from across the rotunda from my seatmate, and the bill went through our committee, essentially for Group B water systems. Those are your smaller water systems. There was a requirement on having a satellite management agency either run or manage the system. For some of our smallest systems, Mr. President, that process is burdensome and costly and really not needed. We have our local health jurisdictions that do their great work, and oftentimes these same satellite management agencies weren't even available in Eastern Washington, just to give you an example. My good seatmate worked this bill really, really hard. We have some exceptions to that I might read, Mr. President.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Group B systems that either provide fire flow, atmospheric storage, serves 10 or more service connections, or must provide treatment to meet water quality standards would not. They would have to continue to have those satellite management agencies. He worked with all of the stakeholders very well. I commend this bill and urge its support. Thank you.
Senator Short was very convincing. The bill passed unanimously. So
that was really nice to see, and I was able to stand in the wings and watch as she gave that speech and see all of the members of the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, vote for it. So that was really a positive feeling. This was a bill had some shaky times at moments when Department of Health got I think they got the wrong idea about what the bill did, and they were concerned about it. I thought for sure it was dead. The day after it passed, I had a signing ceremony with Speaker Jenkins, and she told me, Department of Health told her she didn't like it, and she told them she didn't care because she believed it was a good bill. So that's great to see some bipartisanship and get that bill passed. I'm looking forward to the governor's signature, hopefully sometime this week.
Yeah, I don't think he'll veto that one. I mean, it would be a surprise. But he has to sign it. When the bills are passed in session, doesn't he have a...
He has 30 days.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he has 30 days. So we may not be here, at least I hope we're not, 30 days from now. But one of the things I want to bring up, is the thing that we constantly have to watch, the state agencies and the impact they can have. either positive or negative. And I had a bill that is no longer going to advance this session, and it's one where DNR is opposed to the bill I put forward on making sure their surveyors work with adjoining landowners in a transparent way, making sure that they have options to, you know, provide comment, you know, when you're talking about boundary line adjustments. And look, state agencies can mess with all kinds of things, and it's super frustrating. The state agencies serve at the pleasure of the people, not the other way around. And so I just feel at times they wield a very big stick that, look, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't, you know, have them involved in the process. I had them involved in the process all the way, but it really shows what an outcome they can have, or they can make a bill look more costly to implement than it really is. And they know very well how to work the process, either in their favor or not.
Along that line, Senator Short, I don't think I told you this story, but maybe a month ago we had a senior member of the opposing party come in and testify in front of my committees, and he was asked about the fiscal note attached to one of his bills. And he just kind of got this 1,000-yard stare and said, you know, sometimes when the agency doesn't like your bill, they jack it up and make it look really expensive. And then he goes, oh, did I say that out loud? And the room just burst out in laughter. So I that was kind of an eye-opening moment for me.
Well, I'll say, too, it's something that I've seen. You know, only been here for not quite 3 months, but the bureaucrats do have a lot of power here. And they, the majority party particularly, has a hard time going against their opinions. And oftentimes it's not just you think about the bureaucrats as those state agency people, which is what they are, but a lot of the state agency people down on the ground really understand what's going on. But these people in the government affairs department may or may not fully understand this. Like on my Group B water bill, I think there's people in the Department of Health who work on this program who saw the value of it, but people at the top just saw it as deregulation that they didn't like. And so I was talking with Senate Representative Orcutt the other day, and he made an interesting comment about the term limits idea. And, you know, he said, we have a lot of turnover here naturally. Most of the legislature has only been here a few years. But the problem with term limits is that the bureaucrats would have even more power, because it's invaluable to have people like Representative Orcutt and Senator Short, who've been here for, you know, over a decade, where they've been here maybe longer than some of those bureaucrats. The reality is that those career people get entrenched and they stay here a long time, and most of the legislature flips over a lot.
The answer to that is term limits for the bureaucrats.
Wouldn't that be nice?
It's an institutional knowledge, right? So once you have that, it makes things a lot easier. And so, as you mentioned, it does take some of the legislators who have been here a long time to say, wait a minute, I know where this is going, right? Is that kind of it, Senator Short?
Oh, 100%. You know, the ideas and the things that they do, they cycle. And I'll just use the wood-burning bill as a perfect example of that. It's something I've been fighting against since my time began in the legislature. And once again, I think really that experience and just the knowledge of how they tried to do it in the past really gave pause to them. I'm not saying it always works that way, but just knowing the issue and what we've done over time and what they've tried to do over time, really, I think, gave me at least for the moment a little bit of an upper hand to kill that bill. And so experience, you know, it does matter. So it was really fun to be able to put that bill down.
I guess we should also say there are sometimes where they're invaluable. Their knowledge, I mean, it's hard to legislate without knowing, you know, the ins and outs of an issue. And a lot of times the agencies are the ones who can provide that background information too. So, you know, I mean, it goes both ways, certainly. You had some visitors on Friday, actually. The 7th, we'll call them the 7th District Dozen, because there were 12 of them.
Not the Dirty Dozen, the 7th District Dozen. That's right. We did, Tracy. We had a wonderful group of visitors. Well, first of all, a bit of context. So, of course, it's a long ways to Olympia from the 7th District. And so most of our visitors throughout the session have been kind of in onesies, twosies, people who came over to encourage us or touch base on a specific piece of legislation. We had a few pages over the course of the session, which were wonderful. But we haven't had any kind of larger groups come in so far, and that's just really because of how far away we are. Well, that changed on Friday. We had a group of about a dozen constituents from all over the 7th District come over here to Olympia. These are individuals who are involved in the community. They weren't here really to lobby on any particular piece of legislation. They did want to find out a little bit more about how the process worked. They wanted to challenge us, inspire us, encourage us. And I'll tell you, they came on the most beautiful day of the year. You could not have asked for a more lovely day. The sun was out, the trees were blooming, and for additional context, it's pouring rain today. It's absolutely coming down in sheets. So we had a lot of fun with these individuals. Representative Engel took them on a tour of the a walking tour of the grounds of the Capitol building. Might want to talk about that in a second. We did a walk around the Capitol building itself. But this was just, for me, one of the highlights, to get to touch base with people back home and find out what's on their mind and take their temperature about how the legislature's doing.
It was really great. And I think maybe six, certainly at least five counties that these people came from. And they actually rented a 15-passenger van and drove around the district to pick them up on the way here. And it made it kind of festive. And it was great. It happened at a time when it was between policy cutoff and going to full-time floor this week. And so I had a little more time to spend. And doing the grounds tour was a lot of fun on a beautiful sunny day. I'll admit, I hadn't been to some of those monuments myself, and so I was kind of like self-guided myself and showing them at the same time, and it hasn't been a lot of time to really look at that. And some of those monuments are really moving. I know that some of them said that was the highlight, was seeing some of the, especially the veteran memorials. And it's really special to see. And I think for some of them, they just wanted to understand how things work, and we were able to show them that, show them the floor. They got to see Speaker Jenkins sign my bill. They got to see Senator Short working on the floor. I got to show them some of my systems. You know, we've got over 200 bills that have passed the House, and I was able to show them my system for how I track and put in my notes of what I think about them. And I think they just really understood a lot more about how much content is flowing around here and how they can be more involved in the process. And I really encourage any of the listeners to consider coming over here. We'll try to make your visit just as special.
Well, I think when you think of the time it took to get over here, by the time they picked everyone up and came over to the, you know, to Olympia, they went over four mountain passes. They went over Sherman. They went over Wakanda. They probably went over Blewett and then Snoqualmie. And that just signals, you know, we love where we live. It's, but oftentimes Olympia just has such an impact, not usually in a good way, you know, about those of us and those of them who live, you know, east of the Cascades. So it was a really good time and some hard questions along the way. Like they want to know what's going on and why and about the budgets and how they're out of, you know, they're just out of control. And so it was just a really good time to be with them.
This is your capital, by the way. Everyone is invited. Everyone's welcome. The doors are always open, and I guess not always open, but every day you can come here and get a tour and check it out. It is, if you haven't been here, it's pretty cool. Just overall, it's a neat place to work. I had one person say, I pointed to where I work. I said, I work up there. So why do I get the most majestic office ever? It's like, it is true. It is a pretty majestic. So definitely, if you get a chance to come over and check it out, you know, during the summertime, the weather is fantastic. Now, of course, the legislators won't be here. During the spring, it's like Representative Abel said, it's hit or miss. You get a ton of rain like we have right now, or every once in a while you get a beautiful day. And so I'm glad that your guests were able to see it on a beautiful day. So.
And I do want to emphasize something that was really unique that Representative Engel pointed out was the timing really could not have been better. And the folks who are coming over here said that, well, you know, the timing was kind of just a bit of a grab bag about when it was going to work. This day turned out to be best. And then it turned out that not only was the weather fantastic, but as Representative Engel pointed out, that it fell in a perfect time in the calendar between, you know, when the legislative when the legislature is doing a tremendous amount of work as we go back into the floor, you know, this week. And then, you know, because of that, I had a committee meeting that was canceled. So I had additional time to spend with them. We just ended up having it happened to be on the most beautiful day of the year and maybe one of the most quiet days of the year as far as busyness on the calendar.
So certainly one of the quietest ones I've had.
Could not have worked out better. So much fun.
Well, this is a good opportunity to explain what's going on right now. So we had what's called policy, I don't know, what is the exact title, but it's a policy from the opposite house cut off. So basically all the bills that came over to the Senate from the House, all the bills that came from the Senate to from the House to the Senate.
It does get confusing.
Bills and policy committees, basically every bill has to go through a committee, and if it wasn't heard in committee by Wednesday, right, Senator Schur, wasn't it?
Oh, gosh. By this Wednesday? No, actually,
last Wednesday.
Last Wednesday.
Last
yes.
Wednesday. That
last
means
Wednesday.
The bill is essentially dead for the year, unless it has to do with the budget, and then it has until this Wednesday.
Although we call those bills mostly dead, because if the majority wants the bills, then it's amazing how those bills come back to life. Where we're at right now is the budget committee, the budget committee's phase. And that's not so much of the overall operating budgets, but the individual bills. So right now I have three bills in the Appropriations Committee in the House, which is their budget committee. Ours in the Senate is called Ways and Means, and so we have the House bills now before the Ways and Means Committee. That action will end Tuesday. That is when the next deadline comes, and then we'll be on the floor from here on out until the end of session.
So, yeah, by on the floor, she means we'll be voting on bills, basically,
yep,
for the
yep.
rest of the session.
Senate will be voting on House bills, and the House will be voting on Senate bills. And then, of course, in the middle of all of that, the budgets are being negotiated.
And those bills, sometimes the House makes little changes to a bill, or the Senate will make little changes to the bill, then they have to come back.
That's
right?
Correct. So that's a whole nother process.
It goes back and forth, like a ping pong ball sometimes. I mean, the bill will come to the Senate, it's just like, I just want one little, tiny little change. Well, that means it has to go back to the House, and they have to go through that whole process again. So anyway, that's what's going on right now.
Well, and by the way, they don't go back through the committee process, just to be clear.
Right.
They have, essentially, if any changes were made to House bills, then the House has to approve or decide to approve or deny those changes, and the same with the Senate bills.
For the next couple of days, Representative Abel, I'm assuming you're going to be busy in committee because, as Senator Short mentioned, Tuesday is when the bills have to be out of these fiscal committees, finance being one of them in the House, Ways and Means in the Senate. So basically, I mean, at this point, you have to get all the bills that are that have some sort of fiscal impact, you know, to the floor or they die, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the Finance Committee was originally scheduled to meet starting half an hour ago. Received a message last night saying that we're going to meet at 10 a.m. So that's nice because I was worried I was going to have to miss our radio.
Yeah.
Session. So yeah, in 90 minutes, the Finance Committee will meet, and we've got a number of, you know, bills that we'll be addressing. One of them is a proposal to increase taxes on nicotine pouches, which this was something I didn't know a whole lot about. I've had to learn more about how nicotine pouches are frequently used as a cessation device for people trying to give up smoking. But there is an effort to substantially increase the taxes on nicotine pouches, which I'm generally philosophically opposed to tax increases. That's the way I'm viewing this particular issue. But I've had to learn a lot more about smoking. I should have called on my older brother as an expert witness. He could have filled me in a little bit more about these types of products. But yeah, then we've got a number of proposed tax increases that we'll be looking at over the course of the week.
It just never stops, it seems like, with the tax increases.
Boy, it really doesn't.
This year.
Yeah, I mean, the majority has decided to be aggressive and in some cases creative, and in some cases not so creative about the tax increases that we're proposing. When I say not so creative, they've gone back to some of their, you know, favorite ideas, you know, taxing business, taxing those that create a lot of the jobs in our state. You know, the more creative ideas you know, kind of like the, you know, the wealth tax, that sort of thing, legally dubious. And again, the governor said he's not going to sign it if it comes across his desk. I thought that was very interesting. But that is their, from my opinion, that is their reflexive response to this budget deficit, which is entirely a self-inflicted wound. It's, we got to raise taxes, you know. And I think the Senate Republicans did an invaluable job earlier in the session in proposing a no new tax increase budget, which has been very helpful. When I talk to folks back home, they say, well, you know, it has there been a proposal to address the budget deficit without raising taxes? Like, yes, there is. Let me send you the link. Yeah. Let me forward it on to you. And people are impressed with that. You know, that is a real budget. It shows that it can be done without a massive amount of pain. And so I think that would have been by far the preferred route to go. Unfortunately, the majority had other ideas.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Representative Engel, we were talking beforehand. You found it kind of interesting that some of the governor's comments were consistent with what House Republicans were saying during this all-night debate on the budget.
It was almost laughable. I honestly have chuckled a few times listening to the governor's speech about the budget, because we spent over 7 hours debating this operating budget, and some of the very points the House Republicans made concerning the budget, and then the majority party tried to blast us for bad arguments, and a few hours later the governor makes our same arguments as reasons to not support the budget. And you know, I will say, maybe a little bit sorry for some of the Democrats. That has to feel pretty deflating. And I don't know why they didn't bother to go ask the governor before they spent 7 hours in debate. But
it's interesting, Senator Shore, you mentioned, or Senator, or Representative Abell mentioned it, but Senator Shore, I know that you're very familiar with this Senate budget that Senator Gildon, the budget lead in for Senate Republicans, put out along with Senator Torres, and all Senate Republicans. We developed a list of things on the budget that seemingly the governor agrees with, like protect the rainy day fund. The Senate budget does that. Well, that's what the governor wants. Base the budget on realistic revenue projections. That's super important to the governor, and that was important in the development of the Senate budget. Minimize new investments. Certainly, the Senate Republican budget minimizes new investments. Provide savings and efficiencies. Maintain priorities. Seems like both the governor and the Senate Republicans are in line with that. Do not rely on a revenue source that might be overturned by the courts. That seems like an obvious one for a lot of people. I mean, the wealth tax, even if it is allowed by the courts, still it's a little unclear exactly how much money it's going to raise. And then on the spending side, the governor said he's not going to sign a budget without $100 million for law enforcement hiring grants. That's in the Senate Republican budget, but not in either of the Democrat budgets.
It's just really, you know, it's just been a stunning process thus far. Again, like Rep. Abel said, you know, kind of a self-inflicted, you know, deficit that was due to overspending beyond the revenue that comes into the state of Washington from our hardworking taxpayers, I might add. It's just, and the weird thing, when you look at the Senate Democrats' budget, there's tremendous new amounts of spending in it, and then they do the same thing with this budget that got them in trouble with the last one, which is, well, we're going to put things on layaway. We can't pay for them now, but we're going to pay for them later. I'm like, oh my goodness, we're just back to the drawing board. And if they were to enact all of their tax proposals, that would give them an extra $10 billion with a B, you know, spending capacity. And at that point, folks, what ends up happening, that becomes your new base. That becomes your new base budget, or as we call, maintenance level budget. That means that going forward, it's going to take that much tax revenue all the time to continue paying for it. Right? I mean, now I don't know how many billions of dollars in new spending the budget has at this point, but it's in the billions, and that is just so not. It just really is astounding to me. You get to a point where you're at a loss of words, because it makes no fiscal sense whatsoever. And I wanted to highlight too, This doesn't happen very often. In fact, I don't think it's happened since I've been here. The CEOs of 60 very major Washington companies talked about not just the opposition to the wealth and the job tax. It's called the payroll tax, but it's really the job tax. And the stunning, what an effect, an impact that would have on the state of Washington. Folks, if you are wealthy enough to pay for a wealth tax, or you're an employee who all of a sudden they're going to be paying that payroll tax on you because you make good money, those folks aren't going to stay in the state of Washington. The businesses are not going to stay in the state of Washington. Not only are you going to lose the revenue, you're going to lose those really good paying jobs as a result of that. And their letter was very timely and just really talked about what it would really do in the state of Washington, and really chided the Democrats, for even thinking about a proposals like this. Now, they may or may not enact these, but, you know, if you turn around and look at some tax proposal that they're going to be putting forward, you know, I really worry about the property tax bill, because that is something that I think is the most regressive that's been introduced this session. And again, at a time where homelessness is at an all-time high, the inability of people to purchase homes, all of that. I mean, anything to do with property tax, increases, by the way, in the Senate with no cap on that, really, really is very disturbing.
Tracy, can I hop on and talk just briefly about an additional, what I think is a fascinating dynamic, which is that, you know, as Senator Short pointed out, the governor and the Democrat leadership in the House and Senate do not seem to be on the same page with regard to taxes. You know, that continues to be the case as the session goes along. We'll see what it looks like in the anchor leg part of the session the next few weeks. But I think there's an additional fascinating dynamic here, and that is that the governor and the majority Democrats do not seem to be on the same page with regard to his campaign promise to hire put $100 million more toward law enforcement hiring. So there's a bit of context. Washington State ranks 51st in the country, so behind all the other states, and Washington, D.C., in the number of per capita law enforcement officers. And from my perspective, that's a result of a bunch of different things, including really Olympia kind of, kicking our law enforcement profession in the teeth for, a long time here. I think there's an accurate perception that our law enforcement community believes that, the majority in Olympia and the occupant of the governor's mansion for quite a while has really not been a strong supporter of law enforcement. Basically, a lot of folks don't want to be cops here in Washington State, and that's a problem, and it has led, from my perspective, directly to the public safety crisis that we have. So Governor Ferguson, and to be clear, Sheriff Riker, both ran on campaign pledges to hire a lot more law enforcement officers. Governor Ferguson was elected, and he has said repeatedly now that he's not going to sign a budget that doesn't have this $100 million for law enforcement in there. And that's super interesting because Senator Holey on the Senate side for years has been introducing a bill to provide $100 million for law enforcement. This year, I was honored to introduce the House version of that bill. And what the Democrats ultimately ended up doing, they did not advance Senator Holey's bill. They did not advance my bill. Instead, what they did is they put a bill together which provided $100 million, not for law enforcement hiring, but for any public safety purpose, which could be wraparound, therapeutic services for bad guys, just really kind of whatever, folks want it to mean. And they advanced that out of the House. We don't know yet whether, the governor is going to insist on, a different version of the bill, or whether that was just kind of cover for advancing, the bill that did advance out of the House. But that was going to be an additional fascinating dynamic to see that unfold over the course of the next few weeks. What is the governor going to do about the cop situation?
We're going to just take a quick break here. I want to let you know that we would love to get to your questions. If you have a question, you can email me. It's tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100. More live from Olympia coming up.
Thank you. I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
I'm Shanola Hampton. Every day, millions of people face hunger. Today, I will share with you some of their experiences. I'm stuck between paying for medications or paying for food. John from Maine. After paying my bills, I can buy groceries. It's sad to say, food comes last. Alice from Oregon. I thought pantries were for less fortunate people, but anybody could be less fortunate in a day or even a second. Claire from Virginia. The Feeding America Network of Food Banks helps provide over 6 billion meals to people in need each year. No one should have to worry where their next meal will come from. Together, we can end hunger. Learn more at feedingamerica.org.
Animals are languishing in U.S. shelters, especially dogs who look a certain way. These dogs are just as deserving of loving homes as any type of dog, which is why we decided to help them get out of kennels. Join the thousands of supporters of our mission to help us expand our national reach and proudly place more dogs from kennels into their forever homes. To learn more about our mission, please visit us at kenneltocouch.org.
Welcome back to you live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter Abell on Okanagan Country Radio. I'm your host, Tracy Ellis, with the Washington State Senate Republican Caucus. You can email me with your questions, tracy.ellis@ledge.wa.gov. That's tracy.ellis@leg.wa.gov. Or call 509-826-0100. That's 509-826-0100. We were talking a little bit earlier about visitors from the 7th District, and you have a visitor coming for a very important job on a Friday, Representative Abell.
I do. I'm very excited about this. So the pastor of my church there in Inchilim, Inchilim Community Church, is coming out here to Olympia to offer the opening invocation for the State House of Representatives. So every morning when the House is in session, we are gaveled into session with a presentation of the flags by the pages, the high school students that are here in town for the week, and then an invocation offered from a member of the clergy here in Washington. And one of the neat things that happened when I arrived here in Olympia is I got a message saying if any of the members have members of the clergy that might be interested in delivering the invocation, to please let the office of the chief clerk know. So I asked my pastor, it's Pastor Anthony Annunzio. I said, Pastor Anthony, would you be interested in doing it? And, you know, he was a little nervous and his palms started sweating. He said, come on, it can't be harder than delivering the sermon there at Inchilim Community Church every Sunday. And he said yes. And so I'm really excited about that. As is always the case when somebody comes out here, you know, it's a lot of time to come out here. It's going to be 2 days of travel and a day here. But very excited. So Friday morning, Pastor Annunzio will be giving the opening invocation for the Washington State House of Representatives, which I think that chamber has seen a lot, but I don't think they've seen a pastor from Inchilim come out and give the invocation. So this is the first.
Have we had one from Addie? That's the question.
No, we have not. No, we haven't, but it would be fun if we did. So,
For people I guess in the district, everybody in the South District probably knows where Addie is. I had to go. I had to check it out. So I've checked out both Inchillium and Addie now. And I will say, because I'm not, obviously, I'm from this part of the state. You are from some rural areas, Senator Shorten and Representative Abel. Now, Representative Engel, you're from Colville, right?
Right. So, second largest city in the district.
That's the big
right.
city.
5,000. Yeah,
that's the big city, right? So, anyway. We were talking about the property tax a little bit earlier, and you know, I guess it's one thing for you to hear Republican representatives and senators say, "Oh, yeah, we don't like this property tax," but it's not just them. We had in the Senate there was a hearing on this property tax, and over 43,000 people signed up opposed. That's a record.
They did.
I mean, not even close, right, Senator Shore? I mean,
oh, it blew. In fact, there were times you could not access the system. It essentially shut the system down. So I'm not even sure if those numbers would have been slightly higher than that. But look, just to remind folks, that bill had no cap. So right now, the 1% cap for, you know, any increases in property taxes as far as collections. And this bill would remove that cap completely and make, you know, make increases based on population and inflation growth. The stunning part of that, you look at the state share of the property tax that we all pay, and then obviously we have our local junior taxing districts and so forth. The state property tax part, all it would take is adoption by the legislature to take that increase every year. Think about that. Every year. If we'd have had that in place over the last year or so, we would have been looking at 4.5% property tax increase if you were to use the method they use in the bill. And then the local county commissioners would have an ability to raise theirs without a vote of the people by a councilmanic vote on the local share of the property taxes. And again, it's incredibly regressive. You know, when we were on the Senate floor debating the budget, one of the Democratic members said, you know, we're really only wanting to go after the wealthy. And I said, oh, really? So I got up and spoke and said, really? So that first time home buyer of that fixer-upper house that they're so proud to call their own, they're wealthy by your definition? You know, let's get into that and start talking about that. Are the renters wealthy? Because at some point, these property taxes would end up being increases in rent as well. It's just stunning. I don't know that they've ever told us who they think are wealthy. I think that changes by virtue of the bills they bring forward. But you know, this bill would be incredibly regressive and incredibly hurtful to the majority of Washingtonians.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting you talk about the renters. Maybe we don't talk enough about that, because it's absolutely right, Representative Engel. I mean, you're a landlord. You have apartments. I mean, you know, even if there's, so let's say the rent control bill goes through that restricts rent increases to, what is it, 7% or?
Right.
7%. I mean, that's something, and then your property taxes go up, right? So let's just go in your, but use you as an example. So you've got these apartments, your property taxes go up. You know that you can only raise rent 7%. You just have no choice but to take that 7% increase every year, basically, because property taxes will go up no matter what. I mean, say it's the Senate bill. Okay, we'll just say it's the House. So the House bill raises would allow increases of 3% a year. So that's a 3% property tax every year on top of everything else you pay that goes up as well. I mean, you're going to have to raise rent, right?
There's no other way.
I mean, and you don't like, you've said on this show that you don't like raising rent, and you don't do it unless you absolutely have to. But you're going to have to.
That's right. Because currently, under current law, I rarely raise rent unless someone's there for many, many years, and then I'll, you know, you got to raise it some, but typically you raise it in between tenants. But with the rent control, you won't be able to do that. You won't be able to wait, right? So, and I got one property I know where the property tax had gone up $100. Well, between tax and insurance, $100 a month is increased, and I haven't raised the rent, right? So that's $100 a month backwards that I'm going on that. But, you know, that tenant's been struggling, and I just haven't had the heart to raise the rent. with 7% rent control, I'm going to have to put that 7% on every year, because otherwise you'll fall behind and you never have the option to catch up. And so the property taxes absolutely will, they affect the tenants, they affect everyone. It's not, it's certainly not just the rich. And when the, let's just say I can't raise rent anymore, but the property taxes are going up, this may result in me selling the property if it no longer pencils out. To someone who's probably going to displace those tenants and renovate the place, and then they can raise the rent to whatever they want to. But also, maybe I don't sell it, but I just have to spend less money maintaining or upgrading the units. So it, ultimately, it all comes back on the public. Any of these tax increases, they come back on the people.
And this isn't, I mean, I think some people say, oh, well, you don't have to do this or you don't have to do that. It's like, yes, you do have to. It's not like you have it's a choice in the matter. You know what I mean? Right, Representative? I mean,
that's right.
You're not, it's like, I think some people think that every landlord is this rich baron or something. I mean, it just doesn't.
You do have some of those, but those aren't most of them.
Right.
And those aren't most of the ones in the 7th District. You know, we really want to keep those landlords who live and work in the district, and they save and they buy a handful of rentals where they can build relationships with those tenants. They can learn about people in a different income category than themselves and help build that community. What happens when you make it too complicated and expensive for the small landlords is that they end up selling them to the large corporate ones who don't have that relationship and will just make it as all a money game, and they do whatever makes sense for their bottom line, which often isn't what's best for the community or those tenants.
Yeah, I mean, you go to church with your tenants, you go to, you know, you're at McDonald's, the tenants, you know what I mean? It's just like, I think that's interesting.
No, I think that's super fascinating. Two quick observations. One, we've talked all session long about the housing crisis we have here in the state of Washington, and this rent control effort is going to substantially exacerbate that for all the reasons we've already talked about. But, you know, another thing is with regard to, you know, Rep. Engel, you know, serving as a landlord within his community, you know, that's an investment decision that he and his family have made about a way that they're going to help, you know, support the family. And what a, in a little town like Colville, what a wonderful way to invest in the community as opposed to just buying stocks and bonds, right? I mean, you are invested in the community, and this is another way to do it. And this rent control bill is just, frankly, putting a stick in the spokes over your ability to kind of run your properties the way that would be best for you, your family, and the community.
Well, and you mentioned stocks and bonds, and it's an interesting observation because I have maxed out my retirement loans against my retirement stocks and bonds, right, in order to get the down payments for these rentals. Mm-hmm. And I've foregone, you know, I have siblings who are going on trips to Europe and Hawaii. My family has not taken any trips except for to Olympia and other places in the 7th District, which has been fine, right? That's something a choice we've made, but we've chosen to put our additional surplus money instead of putting into family vacations or a nicer car that doesn't break down every few months into an investment into our future, into our community, so that we can have the opportunity to serve our community through these tenants. And it really is how we see it. We see them as a sort of mission field.
Yeah. And property taxes can also affect, you know, someone in your situation, Representative Abel. I mean, a family wants to keep a ranch, you know, a situation could come up where property taxes get so high that maybe family doesn't want to take on this, you know, behemoth anymore, right?
Right, right. We're dealing with the exact same challenge that every family ranch, family farm deals with, which is that, you know, my folks are getting up there and trying to figure out how to, you know, transition, you know, the place. And you've got, you know, a bunch of siblings. I'm the only one who's still local. And, you know, there's a desire to keep it going as a working operation. But then there's the very practical real world consideration of, you know, do you buy the others out? You know, how am I going to help take care of my folks? There's a tremendous, wonderful asset that, you know, I've committed to doing everything I can to keep it going, but property taxes absolutely play a role in that for sure.
Well, Senator Shore, you made the point, and I think it's worth making again, that some people may end up just losing their, like, we heard from, I don't know if it was on your telephone call, but there was an elderly lady. She said she's in her 70s, her husband's in his 80s. They pay so much more in property taxes now than they ever paid for a mortgage. You know, they're retired, they're on a fixed income. And there's a point they can't afford it. They just don't have the money anymore. You know, either their pension or their Social Security, whatever, isn't going to pay for it anymore. What happens to that person?
Well, it's hard. I will say the bill, and I don't know the specific language. Supposedly, there's an exemption for senior citizens, but again, the challenge is you're hoping the government includes you in that particular demographic, when in fact the government shouldn't be creating such hardship on individuals such that they need that exemption. I will share, so my daughter works in the treasurer's office in Stevens County, and she and I were talking just last week, and she said the number of people who have come in saying they're just having a really difficult time, like they're barely paying their taxes right now. And that's absent any of the things that are going on in Olympia with, you know, she's super concerned. She wanted to talk about the property tax proposals. And she said, Mom, she said, you know, it's the highest it's ever been of people coming in and just saying they are having a really difficult time. And just think about bills like in the House and Senate that put families over the edge.
I mean, these are real stories of real people.
100%.
In the 7th District. You know,
yep.
That's what we're talking about here. I guess, you know, I for the people listening at home, like, yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. You know, it's almost like we wish we could get a few legislative Democrats on this program, listening to this program, so they could hear these real stories about, because I think that's, you know, that's where I think there just seems to be a lack of connection with, because this isn't taxing the rich. Here, right? It's when we talk about property taxes, or when we talk about Senator Short, you know, we were talking about fees for hunting and fishing licenses, you know, going up. I mean, that's not taxing the rich, right? I mean,
so there might be some of us who would call that tone deaf.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I mean, they're not grounded in any reality at all.
Yeah. Talking about the hunting and fishing license increases and the 38% and 50% increase on Discover passes, this is something I spoke about on the floor last week regarding the operating budget. You know, we're talking about going from a $30 to a $45 Discover pass. And I think for a lot of people over here in the Puget Sound region, the idea of an extra $15 causing people to no longer go out into nature and spend time on state lands, it's hard for them to understand that. But I can see it for my own life. Like, I grew up at a time when there was no Discover Pass, and my family went all the time to some of our state parks and state lands. When my kids were first born, we had just implemented this. And it was up just until the last few years, I didn't go. And even last year, I was running for office. I didn't have as much money. My family didn't go to state lands because I didn't buy a Discover Pass. But an extra $15, well, it doesn't sound like a lot of money. I guarantee there's a lot of families in our district whose kids will no longer experience hunting, fishing, and the outdoors because of these fees. And it's hard to explain that to the majority who mostly lives in an urban Puget Sound area with a six-figure income.
Well, and to Senator Short's point about this proposed increase in the hunting and fishing fees being completely tone deaf, one of the things that I know we're always trying to do over here in Olympia is educate the other legislators about how different the 7th District is compared to the rest of the state. And something that I do in talking about my district with other legislators is, particularly on these wildlife issues, is I remind them that we have a lot of folks in our district who rely on hunting and fishing for subsistence purposes. It's not just for sport. It's also how they put food on the table for their family. And so that definitely plays a role in this issue on hunting and fishing license fees, but also on the wolf issue that we've talked about, you know, before in the past. So our district is different. It's one of the reasons that we live out there.
Well, I mean, it's not just your district. I grew up in, you know, Shelton here in the west side of the state, just not far from Olympia. But, you know, it's something Representative Engel said. It's, that was the same thing as a kid. Now, my parents were teachers, you know, but, you know, that's how you spent. That's what you did. You went out to the state parks. That was before you had these Discover Pass fees. But, you know, it's like everything, right? You just have to decide where you cut. You know, it's like, well, can we afford this? Well, maybe this, but maybe not. You just have to find ways, places to cut. And sometimes, like the Discover Pass, maybe one of those things, it's like, well, do we really need it? You know, how important is it? Is that something we can cut?
Well, I think if we were talking about just one in isolation,
right?
If it was a focus to make sure that our state parks were being kept up, you know, the investments and things like that, that's a maybe. But the problem is it's not done in isolation. It's like everywhere you turn, there's increased fees or increased taxes, and then no shortage of proposals to do all of it all over again. And people just, they go like, time out. I mean, it really just bothers people that there's no stopping, whether it's, you know, your gas tax or the fees because of the carbon fees that are being paid to try and force people out of using, you know, gasoline powered cars and trucks. It all affects your bottom line. And that doesn't even take into account, you know, inflation that we've seen. So it's just, none of these are just a one and done. You know, it's the majority of them.
Well, and we're going to talk a lot more about this in weeks following this one. But we are out of time for today. I want to thank you for being with us. We're live from Olympia with 7th Legislative District State Senator Shelley Short and Representatives Andrew Engel and Hunter A. Bell.